You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As we've been hearing, post-traumatic stress disorder is at epidemic levels among returning vets, and now it's spreading to their families. Mac McClelland, an award-winning human rights reporter for Mother Jones, describes the collateral damage borne by the spouses and children of veterans with PTSD and the mounting costs to society. Her article, called Hearts and Minds, is in the latest issue of Mother Jones. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Ms. McClelland to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
What do you mean when you say families of veterans with PTSD can catch the symptoms? This is not a germ-borne problem.
Sure. But it is sort of an interesting use of, you know, contagion, what we usually would consider, you know, something needs to be in order to be contagious. But as a lot of psychologists who work with combat vets and people who've suffered, you know, you don't have to go to war, obviously, to be traumatized. All kinds of people can get PTSD, from assault to, you know, a sudden death, even very serious car accidents. But if you even think about it, even without, you know, calling a psychologist and having him tell you that, you know, a trauma affects everyone around a person who's been traumatized, if you even just sort of think about the symptoms of PTSD, particularly combat PTSD, where you could be having flashbacks, you could be having nightmares, you could, you know, you could wake up screaming, you could wake up screaming and swinging at your spouse who doesn't know when that's going to happen. You don't know what the triggers for PTSD are, you know, anything could set off an episode, and so you're sort of always, you know, on pins and needles, sort of waiting for something to happen. So if you think about just what it would be like to be in a house with a severely traumatized person, it's not, you know, it doesn't take a psychologist to figure that that would impact the other people who were living in the house.
And so it's being called secondary PTSD?
Right, right. Because one person's trauma and the symptoms of their trauma can basically become another person's trauma. You could be traumatized by living with a spouse who has totally unreliable and unpredictable moods, you know, severe emotional outbreaks, violent outbursts sometimes.
Well, and it's we've heard about hypervigilance in regard to veterans who have served in dangerous situations, but this is also something that the wives and children of people with PTSD have to deal with?
Sure. If you live in a house with a person, so for example, you know, one of my sources, the husband who is a combat vet, checks the windows. He checks out the windows hundreds of times in a day. You're sitting in the living room and he gets up and checks the windows, or he walks around to the rest of the house and checks the windows. If you're a five-year-old, you know, and you learn a lot of your behavior from your parents, obviously, and you sort of model their behavior, you can feel the tension and the fear, you know, of one of your parents if that's how they feel all the time. And if you're watching them check the windows over and over and over again, one of the kids that I wrote about in that story, when he goes to a new place, he counts all the exits, and he just keeps counting the exits and counting the exits and telling his mother where they are, and just sort of keeps an eye on them the whole time. And so, I mean, you know, to an extent, like checking them out once, it's good sense, but to just wait, you know, in this sort of paranoid fear for a couple hours maybe of an event is, you know, obviously not normal and not ideal behavior for a child who's in middle school.
Now, I said the wives and children, there are women who are also returning from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD.
Right.
Does this also apply in those cases? Are husbands experiencing secondary PTSD from their wives?
You know, they often get left out. Military husbands often get left out of the research. And out of, in my particular case, all of my sources happened to be, that wasn't by design, they just happened to be military wives. But they, you know, the one woman in the story, she operates a support group, basically, for people with secondary trauma and people who are caregivers to people who have PTSD. And they do have plenty of husband members as well. So it's not just a gender. And, you know, regardless of the gender of your child as well, it could happen to anybody.
Now, we've already been getting a lot of response from our listeners. We have a comment on our show page. This person writes, I know personally as a child of Holocaust survivors that it's impossible to completely shield children or loved ones from the trauma that war imbues. But even the trauma of slavery was passed down in the black community virtually to this day. I do believe that trauma does affect the collective consciousness of the group, even if not directly exposed to the events themselves. It sometimes takes generations, if forever, to recede. Another person, Sally from Brooklyn, asks if it's at all similar to growing up in an alcoholic family. And we have a call from Matt in Brooklyn along these lines. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay, so what's your experience?
Well, I grew up in a household. My father was a World War II veteran. He had me pretty late in his life. But, you know, just growing up, I never quite could put my finger on what was wrong with him because I hadn't really understood the traumatic experiences he went through. And stuff like hypervigilance, he would always lock the doors. He would always, pace around the apartment. Later on I realized how much those sort of activities had really rubbed off on me in terms of misplaced nervousness, hypervigilance, always noticing everything around me. And
what about your mother?
I just thought it was an interesting subject.
What about your mother? Did she have to adjust?
Did
she say your father returned a different man?
She actually didn't know him when he had gone to war. And the only person I ever talked to was an old relative who said, yeah, that he was a completely different person. He went there when he was 20 years old. So I think in a lot of ways, just a normal life had been sort of robbed of him. I mean, it was a huge sacrifice that I really respect. But something that definitely kind of broke him in a way, although he did a lot better than most veterans. I mean, he, lived a happy and productive life. So, but there was no way to know exactly when, he might get set off by something. That's another symptom of PTSD. So,
well, thank you so much for calling us, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
And Mac, you make the point that although this discussion largely is about Iraq and Afghanistan, it probably should go back to every other war. Shell shock was what we called PTSD after World War I, World War II. We never really dealt with the people who had PTSD World War II in Korea. Vietnam is just starting to be acknowledged as a source for serious PTSD. It was called battle fatigue in World War II. So, is this really just something that we're coming to understand only recently?
Well, that's actually sort of one of the most irritating things about it, is that it has been understood actually for a long time. You said you had a comment from someone who mentioned from the child of a Holocaust survivor. The children of Holocaust survivors were actually sort of the beginning of the field of secondary trauma, and they'd been studied quite extensively. There are countless studies from lots of different countries, also not just, from America and not just from America's wars. So there's lots of research, not to mention, more anecdotal evidence than you would ever know what to do with. But there's lots of research about, after Vietnam, after Korea, after World War II, the exact same thing has been happening over and over and over again. And trauma counselors, people in the field are familiar with it. It's just not a part of the national consciousness.
Well, when was it added to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual?
It's not its own diagnosis. It's mentioned, but it's not its own diagnosis. And so you can't, for example, you often can't get treatment from the VA. Some vet centers, which are sort of separate entities, will have counseling for children and spouses, but you can't take your 5-year-old into the VA if you're a veteran and be like, you know, somebody needs to help this kid. They have very limited resources for families, even though, you know, this is really old news. My particular, you know, my best friend actually is the daughter of a Vietnam veteran, and she goes to the same kind of trauma counseling that someone who had been to war recently would. You know, these, and she's in her 30s. So the thing about trauma is that if you don't treat it, it never really goes away, and those sort of after effects can build and really become a part of your personality and impact, you know, just your quality of life.
Now, you said that PTSD isn't added to the DSM. Actually, it is. It's secondary PTSD.
Yeah, that's what I meant, that, secondary trauma.
Yeah. At last count, how many American service members who served in Iraq or Afghanistan have PTSD? Do we have any real sense of how big this problem is?
Yeah, it kind of depends on who you ask, you know, who's doing the counting. But there's, you know, the very low estimates are, you know, around 100,000, but the higher estimates are, you know, 300, 400,000. The VA has treated hundreds of thousands from Iraq and Afghanistan, and, you know, that's knowing that large percentages of people who suffer from PTSD never get treatment at all. And, of course, so those people don't get counted.
Haven't there been studies related to other wars about secondary PTSD? For example, one that shows that 30 to 40% of the wives of Croatian war vets have secondary PTSD?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I was saying before. There are studies of the spouses and children of lots of wars in lots of different countries that show that they, you know, can pick up some of the symptoms and have, in some cases, for example, you know, even when they get older, they still have some behavioral issues. They have higher rates of substance abuse sometimes. They have higher anxiety, things like that. So, yeah, I mean, the literature, there's plenty of literature to go through if you want sort of evidence about how long we've actually known that secondary trauma is a problem.
Who is Caleb Vines, and how does PTSD affect him?
Caleb Vines is this extremely brave guy he's an Iraq vet. He did 2 tours. And the story that I did in Mother Jones, which actually you can find on our website now, he and his wife sort of let me into their life in Alabama for a couple weeks to spend some time with them and see how he has not just PTSD, but also TBI, which is traumatic brain injury, which in a lot of cases can exacerbate some of the symptoms of PTSD. And he suffers, you know, a lot of the same symptoms that other people do. He has flashbacks. He has nightmares. He has super intense anxiety. Like most veterans who are being treated for PTSD by the VA, he's on this extraordinary pharmaceutical cocktail. He takes 11 or 12 different medications a day, you know, antidepressants, anti-anxiety, because that's one of the key, you know, treatment plans that the VA is pursuing. So they, you know, they sort of try to make do, but they are aware that this is obviously impacting their marriage. You can imagine if you are on that much medication and have the kind of symptoms of, you know, super intense hypervigilance and high anxiety that, you know, it affects your intimacy, obviously, and your ability to be able to just have sex with your spouse and just have, like, a normal breakfast with your spouse without something necessarily setting them off. And they have a 6-year-old in the house who is trying to cope while the two of them are trying to cope with it. And
you so say that she mirrors her father's behavior sometimes.
Sure, she does, which is not surprising. She is. She gets in a lot of trouble at school, unfortunately. She's such a sweetheart, but her mother has had to have a lot of conferences with her teacher, with her kindergarten teacher, because she, you know, she has space issues. She will start yelling. Her dad yells a lot, not on purpose and not even always at someone, but sometimes even just from his room you know, where he will hide sometimes for 20 hours a day. He will just, like, the house will erupt with the sounds of him screaming. And so it's not really surprising that she's picked up some of these behaviors. You know, she's just a baby, basically.
And what's happened to his wife, Brandon, who's essentially his caretaker, also has to cope with Katie's problems? Is she also showing signs of secondary PTSD?
Sure. She is, she's hypervigilant, like a lot of military spouses and caregivers end up being. So she has the same sort of always on, two on, you know, like all her nerves sort of firing, like nervous, anxious, looking around, like your hearing is heightened, you know, when you're in that kind of a state. It's sort of like a shaky, like sweaty. She basically operates at that level at this point all the time. So, you know, in the story I talk about how she's in a drugstore and just the smallest thing when you're already that keyed up can really sort of set you off into a meltdown. There's another military wife who I talk about in the story who somebody drops a tray in a steak restaurant that she's in and she just loses it. Like the sound is just like way too much and just freaks her out and she starts sobbing. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that can happen when you live with hypervigilance.
Well, Brandon Vines started an organization, a nonprofit called Family of a Vet. And when we come back, we'll talk a bit about that. My guest is Mac McClelland, whose article, Hearts and Minds, PTSD is already an epidemic at epidemic levels among returning vets. Now it's spreading to their families, is in the February issue of Mother Jones. Stay with us. We are back with Mac McClelland, whose article, Hearts and Minds, is in the latest issue of Mother Jones. And we were talking about Brandon Vines. She started a nonprofit called Family of a Vet. What does it do?
Well, it basically provides support to anybody who, frankly, most people come to them through frantic Googling, which is actually how Brandon started the group herself. You know, after her husband got back from his second tour, he was so different and their life was so different and it was so tough that, you know, she sort of turned to the internet in desperation and was trying to find someone else who knew what she was going through. And who she found was actually the founder of a support group for Vietnam veterans' wives who had started a group in the 80s. And so she started her own group for, I mean, they'll talk to people from any war, obviously, but mostly it's for the wives and husbands of Iraq and Afghanistan vets. And it's basically a huge support group. If you can't figure out how to get your VA benefits, which takes an extraordinary amount of paperwork and has, you know, untold numbers of hang-ups, she will help people figure out how to do it. If you just want to talk to someone about what is happening to your own emotional state or in your life or, you know, with your child, then you can commiserate basically with thousands of other people who are going through the exact same thing. And so sort of, you know, feel the community support.
And you mentioned that military wives she talks to get beaten up by their husbands or fear being raped by them. Is that common?
Yeah, it's not uncommon for people, especially combat vets with PTSD, will, you know, sometimes domestic violence is unfortunately where that goes, especially in conjunction with substance abuse. A lot of people with PTSD who, you know, can't feel better self-medicate, obviously, and an emotional disorder and, you know, drugs or alcohol can be a formula for domestic violence. So Brandon does counsel and support people who go through all kinds of, you know, new traumas, domestic violence and rape, unfortunately, being some of them.
She writes on the Family of a Vet website that children need to have a safe word, what she calls an Avalon. What's an Avalon?
You know what? We never talked about that before.
She says it's a safe place to hide. which is interesting.
Yeah. I know where their kids is. I don't know if I should say where it is, but they practice that in their own house, actually.
So she has an area, but they also have a safe word. I guess it's a way of saying stop.
Sure, or that you've had enough. I mean, it's important for one of the key things is that you have to get coping skills. You know, unfortunately, we're not really taught coping skills in, you know, culturally. We don't have a lot of, I mean, if you could name, like, could you just come up off the top of your head with some coping skills that anybody ever taught you? You know, it's not really common. So you do have to teach your children, if they live in this sort of environment, you have to teach them a lot of coping skills so that, you know, hopefully it doesn't just build up, all this trauma doesn't just build up and then overwhelm them at some point. You know, she counsels people who have children in middle school who try to commit suicide, which is, you know, very, very young, obviously, and they have all sorts of emotional problems. And so the family of a vet does a lot of work for trying to help your kids out, especially if you can't get your kids into counseling. And it's, you know, it's harder to find when you live in rural Alabama, you know, or someplace like that, or you don't have great insurance, or you don't have tons of disposable income. It's hard to find a child psychologist who specializes in trauma, you know, who can help your kids. So they do a lot of work around trying to help the parents support the children while they're sort of all going through this together.
Are there data on the divorce rates for returning vets from Iraq and Afghanistan? Or Vietnam vets, which we have a much longer period to draw from?
Yeah, I mean, they're much higher than in the general population. They're still doing, you know, the numbers on the impacts of Iraq and Afghanistan are still coming in, obviously. There's a longitudinal study that's going to go on for decades, and that's going to have, I think, 10,000 families in it for Iraq and Afghanistan that will sort of keep tabs on those numbers and show us a fuller picture. It'll be the biggest study like that of its kind ever done. And so hopefully, you know, when those numbers come in, people will feel like there's a definitive enough, you know, list of evidence and stats to really take this problem seriously.
Now, Elizabeth from Missouri left a comment on her show page. She says she is now divorced due to PTSD from 9/11.
Yeah, actually, if you look at the studies, I was thinking about that when you mentioned one of your other commenters said something about, you know, just sort of a global consciousness, like a community consciousness. Because after 9/11, and obviously people who weren't in New York were pretty far away from, even some people who were in New York were pretty far away from what was, you know, the main center of action. But the national studies of PTSD after 9/11 were huge. There were lots of people who were reporting the sort of same symptoms, hopelessness, you know, sort of hyper-awareness, alertness, irrational fear of disasters, things like that. For most people, you know, who weren't right near ground zero, that faded in a relatively, you know, normal period of time. Because the thing about post-traumatic stress is that, I mean, it is totally normal. It is totally normal to be distressed by traumatic events, but the you know, ideal way that would pan out would be that after a couple weeks or a couple months, that would sort of fade. When it doesn't, and when it keeps on or sometimes even gets worse, that's when you get into the more severe cases of PTSD.
My guest is Mac McClelland, who is an award-winning human rights reporter from Mother Jones. Her article, Hearts and Minds, is in the latest issue of that magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What are considered to be the most effective therapies and treatments for PTSD? And how much is the government spending on research to develop them?
The government is spending on, they have, I can't remember the exact number, but it's more than 100 studies right now on trying to figure out what the best way is to treat PTSD. Currently, if you were a combat vet and you went through the VA, you would probably be given cognitive behavioral therapy or group therapy. There's a lot, they use a lot of group therapy at the VA. There are other practitioners who would, you know, disagree that that's the best way to treat. Some people use EMDR, which is eye movement. It's a it's a sort of a controversial but fairly widespread now practice. I mean, there's the list of possible therapies is, I mean, there are dozens.
Beta blockers,
hundreds.
And even MDMA, which more popularly known as ecstasy.
Yeah, well, that's, they're still sort of in the beginning phases of those. Obviously, it hasn't been approved. You know, it's not FDA approved. You can't go to your pharmacist and get ecstasy for your PTSD treatment. But those studies are very promising. There's lots and lots and lots of promising studies going on with all kinds of different. Yoga, for example, has proven to be extremely effective, and the VA has studies going on that they're sponsoring that are about meditation and yoga and sort of very non-army sounding things. So, you know, no one can quite put their finger on what exactly the best thing is, and people are sort of trying all sorts of things now.
Well, you mentioned earlier that traumatic brain injury compounds the effects of PTSD, but hasn't the government been resistant to research on the impacts of traumatic brain injury?
Well, there was a period, you know, for the first 10 years of the Iraq war and, you know, subsequently that we had, you know, millions of soldiers come back who had never been screened. But for the first 10 years or so of the war, they weren't resting after they were suffering concussions or after they were in serious explosions. So that's what happened to Caleb, the guy I talked about in the story. He was in a ton of explosions. Somewhere he lost consciousness, and then he would be sort of dragged back to base, and he would be given, like, an IV and some Motrin, and then he would be back out on patrol, like, immediately. And when you get concussion upon concussion upon concussion, you know, it's just like they would tell you in an emergency room, or, you know, the same trouble that the NFL is having and has been having for a long time now. You can get permanent brain damage. And so now they have rules where you have to rest if that happens. So they're hoping to cut down, but that didn't go into effect until a couple years ago. And so they were a little slow on the uptake for best practices for, you know, preventing traumatic brain injury, and it can be difficult to get the proper screening even after you get back. In Caleb's case, you know, Brandon, his wife, had to call the VA, you know, who knows how many times to ask them to screen him and give him the test because they kept saying, he sounds like he's fine. It seems like he's fine. You know, you probably don't really need these tests. Just see how it goes. And finally, when she got him tested, he, you know, turned out to have serious traumatic brain injury. So
there's also often resistance from the vets themselves because they think they should just man up and get past this.
Yeah, of course, because we don't really have a lot of support for trauma built into our culture, unfortunately. You know, that's sort of, it's not just vets especially, you know, because they're men and they're soldiers, but in general, you know, it's hard to get support and the understanding and the empathy that you need when, in general, when something bad happens to someone and they're not coping with it. After a short period of time, people around them will be like, you know, come on, get over it. Like, it's been enough time. You should be fine now. And unfortunately, that's not how trauma works. Sometimes it takes a really long time, and the lack of support in the community, and in particular, you know, as can happen among soldiers sometimes, it can be a real impediment to people getting better.
Now, haven't you written in the past about how you came to have secondary PTSD because of things you witnessed in Haiti?
I have written about that before. I do have PTSD. I'm still in counseling for it.
Is that what led you to write this article?
No, although that is part of the reason why I know these people, because after I wrote about having PTSD, I got, you know, hundreds and hundreds, and I wrote that probably about a year and a half ago, and I still get at least an email a week from a total stranger who probably, again, with frantic Googling, stumbles upon it when they're trying to figure out what's wrong with them and if they're the only people who are experiencing that. That's how I got introduced to a lot of the sources that I talked to in the story.
Well, what happened to you? You witnessed atrocities in Haiti, including rape and mutilation of a woman. How did it present itself?
You know, probably, you know, the first thing is that I started, I didn't feel safe. I felt really worried and anxious all the time. I cried a lot. You know, I couldn't stop crying. When I got back home, I couldn't get out of bed. Sometimes I would just, you know, I would have some sort of episode where I would randomly start throwing up, or, you know, I would smell something and it would set something off, and I would dissociate, which is this common response to trauma, which basically just means that you sort of can't reconcile real life with, you know, you can't feel your body, you can't feel your limbs. You feel like you're watching a movie and not like you're actually in the world, which in fact you are. So it was I had a whole host of nightmares, flashbacks. I had a whole host of symptoms.
But did people just tell you to get past it?
I live in San Francisco with a lot of very sensitive, and happen to be surrounded by a lot of very sensitive and bleeding heart types who might be more prone to extended sympathy than others, possibly. But, I was in counseling, like, right away. So no matter what anyone around me was saying, I had a therapist who was like, this is normal, this will take time, this is fine, you know. So, I mean, I was in, within, like, a day, I was in counseling, which is pretty rare, because a lot of times people just don't know, you know, they have no idea what's happening to them. And frankly, I didn't either when I was diagnosed with PTSD, I was like, what? That sounds like something, you know, that should be for veterans, not for me.
We have a link to Mac McLellan's article, Hearts and Minds, in the current issue of Mother Jones on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being on our show.